Hey everybody, welcome to The New Deal. In this episode, Cuomo is in trouble in New York. I take a closer look at last week's January 6th hearings and what's going on with Brett Kavanaugh. Let's get to it. Everybody, welcome to the New Deal podcast. I'm your host, Jerry Nutini. For more from the New Deal, head on over to thenewdeal.com for podcast episodes, blog posts, and YouTube videos. Please follow on Facebook, YouTube. Head on over to medium.com for some articles over there. And please, 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 wherever you are, podcast, YouTube, rate and review. Let me know how I'm doing. I would really appreciate it. Got a lot to get to today. And we're going to start off with COVID-19. Because we have to talk about COVID-19 in every episode, because COVID-19 is relevant every single week, because who knows why? Shouldn't be the case. But here we are. As of today, August 6th, we have officially hit 50% vaccination in the United States, even though vaccines have been available to all of America for over 2 months, with many eligible long before that. It took until today to get to 50% vaccination for the United States. So we are, you know, happy about it. Great milestone. Wish I'd come a month sooner. Even with the 50% vaccination, COVID cases are soaring in the country, primarily in the Southeast. And I'll pick on those states in a little bit here. But COVID is surging due to the Delta variant. It's affecting basically everyone. The Northeast states and, you know, the North Central states are doing relatively well. But still, the cases are ticking up there as well. We've got breakthrough cases, not many, not much to talk about. I honestly think the breakthrough cases are overreported. They're not serious. They're not severe. They were expected, and they make up like 0.001% of all COVID cases. But that's all we're hearing about is breakthrough cases. Doesn't make much sense, but let's sensationalize it. So COVID, once again. First, Florida and Texas. What are you doing, Florida and Texas? Greg Abbott down there in Texas and Rob DeSantis in Florida are ruining it for everybody. In the two states that are seeing some of the worst COVID outbreaks in the country, these two governors are actively fighting against any mask mandates, any regulations, anything to stop the virus from spreading. They are literally making it worse. Rob DeSantis and Greg Abbott must love lockdowns, even though they're, you know, trying not to give mandates and lockdowns, because the only reason you would try to spread the virus is to get lockdowns, unless you hate the people that live in your state, in which case maybe you're trying to kill them. But let's try to think that, you know, they're not terrible people. Vaccination rates are beginning to tick up slightly across all states as the reality of the situation sinks in, that those who chose not to get the vaccine won't simply just be okay because other people got vaccinated. They can't rely on herd immunity from the people who, you know, did the work. There's not enough people that got vaccinated, and now we're seeing this pandemic of the unvaccinated. Every day, there are news stories of people being hospitalized, and these people are begging to get the vaccine, and the doctors have to tell them it's too late. Vaccines are preventative. They're not a cure. You can't get the vaccine while you're here, sick with COVID, ready to be put on the ventilator. Too late. Sorry, guys. And it's really sad. And a lot of those people die. In almost all deaths after Memorial Day, every single one, they were almost completely preventable, because I believe it was as of May 12th, all adults in the U.S. could have been vaccinated. So all the deaths after Memorial Day, May 12th plus 2 weeks, were preventable. Shouldn't have happened. And they did. A lot of these people that we see unvaccinated in the hospital, you know, they're making videos, they're begging people to go get the vaccine, saying what a mistake they make. And it just stinks, because a lot of them die and they're leaving their family members behind. And I would never want to be in that position where I'm on my deathbed knowing that I didn't need to be on my deathbed, and my family is going to be without me or without my income. Death is painful. And so then you're inflicting that pain upon your family because you wouldn't get a shot. And I can't imagine being in that position. I don't know if I could die content or happy. I think I'd die really miserable and really guilty. And I don't wish that upon anybody. But I don't think people think that far ahead. That's what that looks like. That's what the end looks like when you don't get vaccinated, you get COVID-19, you get the Delta variant, and you have a hard time with it, you end up in the hospital, and you die. Family's affected, you're affected, obviously. It's just not a great situation. People really need to get vaccinated, and this is only going to get worse the closer we get to the winter. And no one wants it to get worse as we get to the winter, but we are way above in cases right now where we were last year at this time. And that's insane since 50% of the population is vaccinated. Part of the problem is that there was a social contract, and that social contract said, if you are vaccinated, you don't have to wear a mask. But if you choose not to get vaccinated, you still need to wear a mask. But all the people who didn't get unvaccinated, very few of them are wearing the masks and doing what they need to do responsibly. So we've basically gone back to normal with 50% of the country having changed nothing, still spreading the virus as if we had no vaccine whatsoever. And now our cases are higher this year with a vaccine than they were this time last year without one. And that is awful. We are failing miserably. We put too much faith in people who didn't get the vaccine that they would be responsible. They weren't responsible to begin with. They didn't want lockdowns and masks to begin with. You know, the vast majority. I don't want to group everybody in. There are medical reasons not to get it outside of the typical distrust of science. And so we'll exclude that 0.001% of people who fall into that category from all the rest of the people who need to go get vaccinated so that this doesn't go on forever. Thank you. The next thing is that new cases are no longer a viable metric in which we should be basing our actions or our reactions moving forward. Because with the vaccine, many cases that are out there are much less severe, much less fatal. So if there's a bunch of cases up in the Northeast where we've got like 70% vaccination up here, a lot of, the, you know, we might have seen an increase in cases, but they're probably not bad cases. We really need to be looking at hospitalization and death at this point, because that shows how much severe illness is there and primarily unvaccinated people are dying. So we need to look at those numbers as our metric for whether we need to lock down or do a mask mandate or things like that. I feel that's my personal opinion. In the last 7 days, just to put this out there, statistically, not picking on these states, just spelling out the reality, we've seen a big increase in COVID over the last week. In Kansas, we had 20 deaths. Missouri, 21. Louisiana, 44. Illinois, 20. North Carolina, 21. Florida, 84. Texas, 60. Those states, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, seven states, those seven states have a total of 270 deaths over the last week. Seven states, 270. The other 43 states combined for a total of 211 deaths. Those seven states have more deaths in them than the rest of the country combined. Combined. And the bulk of those is in Florida, 84 deaths, and Texas, 60. There are states who had no deaths last week. Many states had no deaths last week. Florida had 84. And they've got a governor who says no mandates. Doesn't believe in COVID. They're past it. Basically, like, just get over it, guys. We're not doing anything about it. Those 84 people, whatever happens, is DeSantis's viewpoint. It's ridiculous. It's irresponsible. It's wrong. Never mind the vaccine data from the CDC on efficacy rate or side effects, okay? I know he said that, you know, new case amounts shouldn't be the metric on which we base our actions, you know, like mask mandates and lockdowns. However, all you need to do is look at the map of new cases and deaths to see that there is a direct correlation between the states that are least vaccinated and the number of new cases as well as deaths. The most vaccinated states have the least amount of cases and deaths. What does that tell us? That tells us that the vaccine works. Universally across the board. That is all the information anyone doubting the vaccine should need to know, because there are no bad side effects. It's been a year and a half since the first trials. People aren't, you know, growing a second head. Nothing like that. So go get the vaccine so that we can stop killing people. Thank you. Moving on. The next thing is Andrew Cuomo. Andrew Cuomo is the governor of New York. He's the brother of Chris Cuomo, who appears on CNN, who has a job at CNN. And you might best remember Andrew Cuomo from the early days of COVID. He kind of became the face of how America should do COVID the right way, in contrast to Trump. We had Trump, who was saying nothing, and then we had Cuomo, who was holding a daily press conference on, you know, the things he was doing for New York, which was the, you know, epicenter of the pandemic at the time, and going through all the things they were putting in place, all the restrictions they were putting in place, how they were managing things. And New York kind of became a model for America on how we should handle COVID, since we didn't have leadership from the White House. So every day, most news stations covered Andrew Cuomo, his press conference. And it was like, wow, this is great. This guy is a leader. He can do it. He's doing a great job here. He's very organized. New York, the cases are dropping. They're doing everything right. This is fantastic. We need to pay attention to what's going on in New York so that we can follow suit and maybe save the country, since once again, there was no leadership from the White House. That was just over a year ago, maybe a year ago, and a lot can change in a year. So it's come out, or had been hinted at, that Andrew Cuomo had an issue with sexual harassment in the workplace, or regular harassment in the workplace. And the attorney general in New York began investigating this. And this week, a report came out that detailed the extent of that behavior, Cuomo's behavior. And there are also some ongoing scandals as well. If you can remember, a few months ago, it came out that Cuomo was misrepresenting the situation in the nursing homes in New York State. He was downplaying the numbers of deaths, downplaying the number of cases, and it looks like that was done intentionally. So we already have that. That's already there. But now we get this. This report was big. The attorney general's name is Letitia James, and her office found that Governor Cuomo's actions violated multiple state and federal laws. 11 women's accounts were included in the report, and 9 of them either are employed or were employed by the state of New York, and that includes the state trooper, who was part of his security detail. In all, during this investigation, 179 witnesses were consulted. That's a huge amount of witnesses. The team was led by former federal prosecutor June H. Kim and employment attorney Ann Clark, and they reviewed 74,000 pieces of documentation, including emails, texts, and other evidence. Big investigation. Widespread. The women alleged in the report that Cuomo on multiple occasions either grabbed or groped their breasts, ran and pressed his hands on various parts of their bodies, including their stomachs, back, legs. He made sexually suggestive and gender-based comments about their appearance and asked them about their love lives and more, all that kind of stuff. He would tell women that they look great for their age, or ask them what they thought about monogamy, and told them that they weren't ready for work if they weren't dressed nicely or wearing makeup. You know, chauvinistic shit. It's a lot. The report was scathing. It was well done, obviously very well investigated, and Cuomo decided he was going to try to defend himself. So, people deserve a defense. So, what did Cuomo have to say?
I do kiss people on the forehead. I do kiss people on the cheek. I do kiss people on the hand. I do embrace people. I do hug people, men and women. I do on occasion say, ciao, Bella. On occasion, I do slip and say sweetheart or darling or honey. I do banter with people. I do tell jokes, some better than others. I am the same person in public as I am in private.
I kiss people on the forehead. I hug people. I embrace people, male, female, whatever. Now, a lot of that behavior is relatively normal. You know, people shouldn't be made uncomfortable. And so people shouldn't assume that they can just, you know, kiss people on the forehead and stuff like that. But for a long time, that behavior generally was accepted by society-ish. But that doesn't address any of the things he actually did. Actually, during that speech he was giving there, there was like a montage of like him kissing people and hugging people and embracing people. And it's like, yes, we all hug people. We all embrace people. We all treat the, you know, people we love with respect and kindness. That's not what we're talking about, Andrew Cuomo. We are talking about you sexually harassing women in the workplace, touching them inappropriately, touching their private parts inappropriately and without consent, making lewd comments at them. You didn't address that at all in your defense. No, we got a montage of you touching a bunch of other people. It was weird. It didn't make sense. I understand the need to try to defend yourself if you think you've done nothing wrong. I think he knows he did something wrong. This stuff has been too prevalent in the news for him to think that he's somehow not guilty of the things that he's done with this many accusers and a report that found such damning information. But we are talking about a man who many Democrats felt was the answer to the ignorance of Trump in the height of the pandemic. He was on TV every single day showing the great strides he was making in America's original COVID epicenter and how, you know, he was an example to other states and how COVID could be contained and controlled. And he knew that. He knew that he was being looked at in that way. He knew that, hey, maybe my political career is taking off. So rather than do the right thing, which I think is resign, we've got this awful defense, which makes him look so much worse. Especially when President Biden is calling for your resignation. Nancy Pelosi is calling for your resignation. The New York State Assembly is likely to move forward with impeachment. They're also calling for your resignation. The New York senators are calling for your resignation. Many people in America, many American citizens, Democrats are calling for your resignation. Probably a good idea to resign. And I do want to say this on a slightly different topic. Democrats hold our own accountable. We apply our standard across the board. When we say we don't tolerate unethical behavior, we mean it. And we hold our own accountable. When Al Franken, when that picture came out involving Al Franken, he was gone within 2 weeks. Democrats, top to bottom, called for his resignation. He resigned very quickly. And he was a potential presidential candidate. He was really high profile, gone, 2 weeks. And Cuomo, the day the report comes out, Democrats, top to bottom, once again, said Cuomo needs to resign. It's not okay. This behavior is not okay. The people who represent us in government should be the best of us. We should not have to settle for people who have these types of scandals surrounding them. We shouldn't have to assume that, like, every candidate has some weird sexual thing going on in the background, or that like people like Trump are talking the way he's talking to Billy Bush and among everything else that he did and stuff like this. This is not normal. This behavior is not normal. We have better options for candidates. Pick the candidates who don't have this kind of baggage. And if you find out they have this kind of baggage, take them off the ballot. Don't vote for them. Don't dignify their behavior with elevating their position in society. No, hold them accountable. You know, people would say that part of the Democrats' problem is, you know, we're naive. And because we do things like hold our own accountable, we're hurting ourselves politically. And it's like, who wants to play that game? Who wants to be in a position where it's like, oh, yeah, well, you know, we'll just forgive his sexual harassment because he's a Democrat in New York. He's the governor. We don't want to lose that spot, right? No. There are many things that transcend politics, and holding to our ethics is certainly one of them. So in any situation, Democrat, Republican, Independent, whatever, whether you supported them or not, whether you voted for them or not, if they do something like this, you should be calling for their resignation, which is why it was so frustrating to Democrats when so many members of the Republican Party did not hold Trump accountable for anything, and many continue to not hold him accountable for anything. And he did way bigger stuff, all things considered. For instance, the January 6th insurrection, which I'd like to talk about here. Now, it was just a few weeks ago that we had all that stuff going on with the January 6th commission and Pelosi not seating McCarthy's people and McCarthy going on TV and throwing a fit and pulling his guys from the team. And a lot happened. It was a big story for several days. And then we have since gotten some different news, and then we have a hearing. And I just want to take a look at what's happened since, and then really take a look at the hearing. I know it was, you know, the week before last, but I think there's a lot of important stuff in there, including some of the officers' testimony. So Let's back up a little bit. After refusing to see Jim Jordan and Jim Banks, Nancy Pelosi appointed Republican Adam Kinzinger to the panel. So we've got Kinzinger Republican as well as Liz Cheney Republican, both appointed by Pelosi on the panel. Pelosi was going to seat McCarthy's other three appointees, but McCarthy pulled them out of spite. As is typical with many GOP members, a new conspiracy was painted by Jim Banks after he was not allowed to be seated. And this theory alleged that Nancy Pelosi was actually responsible for the breakdown in security on January 6th, which is, of course, absurd. Explain why. Here's some background. On Fox News, Banks, who had arranged a trip to join Trump at the southwestern border because people still talk to Trump, Banks blamed Pelosi for the security breakdowns at the Capitol during the breach by the Trump people. Banks claimed without evidence that he was rejected from the committee as part of a cover-up. What would this cover-up be? A cover-up for Nancy Pelosi to protect herself? Would a person who's trying to protect themselves from being found out about something establish an entire commission to examine the very event that would likely implicate them? That would be weird. Also, would that person, I don't know, see two Republicans on the committee anyway and have been open to three additional? Would that make sense? I don't think so. Doesn't make sense. Half of the stuff these people say doesn't make sense. I've said it before. I'll say it again. If you're going to try to lie to the American people, if you're going to try to like pull the wool over their eyes, can you please be smarter about it? Please. It is insulting for this type of very terrible attempts at deception and misdirection. Step it up, guys. Did you go to college? Can you think for yourself? It's a cover-up. Think before you speak. Even if you're not serious about it or pretending to be serious about it, please do better. Do better. Banks asked, why was there a systemic breakdown on security on January 6th? At the end of the day, Pelosi is ultimately responsible for the breakdown of security at the Capitol that happened on January 6th. Now, here's where he's probably getting that from. It is up to congressional leaders to hire some of the law enforcement personnel responsible for Capitol security. However, they're not typically involved in day-to-day decisions about those security protocols. So, security at the Capitol is controlled by the Capitol Police Board, and that board includes the House and Senate Sergeant at Arms and the architect of the Capitol. At the time of the attack, the House Sergeant at Arms, Paul Irving, had been on the job since 2012, and Irving was hired by then Speaker of the House John Boehner, an Ohio Republican. The Senate Sergeant-at-Arms, Michael Stenger, was hired in 2018 when Mitch McConnell hired him. So both of the Sergeant-at-Arms were hired by Republican leaders, Boehner and McConnell. But remember, that really doesn't mean much because Boehner and McConnell didn't handle day-to-day security. They hired these gentlemen to do that. Neither of them were hired by Pelosi. Just as a point of fact, both Irving and Stenger, along with the chief of the Capitol Police at the time, Stephen Sund, resigned under pressure after the riot. So they took responsibility for their actions. Since the attack, it's been made clear that there were massive communication failures between the Capitol Police, the Pentagon, the sergeants at arms, and the National Guard. And some of that miscommunication may have been intentionally used as a way to delay the arrival of backup in order to let the attack play out. That theory is actively under investigation, and there are many facts out there that suggest that somebody didn't want the National Guard to come in. Whether that call was made from the Pentagon or above the Pentagon, we don't know, but that's what we have heard. So that's currently under investigation. That's something this commission is trying to figure out. But the GOP isn't just targeting Nancy Pelosi. In fact, members of the GOP are calling for Cheney and Kinzinger to be punished for joining the commission. They're calling for them to be primaried or to have funds withheld from their reelection campaigns because they are joining a fact-finding committee that Republicans had every opportunity to be on twice. And they just gave it up. They gave it up. To their credit, Cheney and Kinzinger have been fantastic in serving the American people in their roles. The other interesting thing here is that there's a chance that members of Congress, such as Kevin McCarthy and Jim Jordan, might actually be subpoenaed to testify given their supposed roles in interacting with Trump in the days and hours leading up to the insurrection. So one of the people, McCarthy, was responsible for appointing people to the commission, might be subpoenaed. And one of the people that he tried to appoint to the commission, Jim Jordan, might also be subpoenaed. That's not suspicious at all. So moving beyond the logistics of it, what actually happened at the hearing? At the hearing, we had four officers representing the Capitol Police and the DC Metro Police. We had Sergeant Gunnell of the Capitol Police and Officer Harry Dunn of the Capitol Police and Officer Michael Fanone of the Metro Police and Officer Daniel Hodges of the Metro Police. What I want to do now is I've got several clips that I want to play from each of their testimony and just kind of reflect on afterwards. The first is Liz Cheney speaking to Sergeant Gunnell, and this is a conversation happening in regard to Donald Trump saying that it was a loving crowd, it was hugs and kisses at the crowd, and making light of the events on January 6th. So here's Liz Cheney questioning Sergeant Gunnell in reference to those comments made by Trump.
Officer Gunnell, when you think about that and share with us the vivid memory of the cruelty and the violence of the assault that day, and then you hear former President Trump say, quote, "It was a loving crowd. There was a lot of love in the crowd." How does that make you feel?
It's upsetting. It's a pathetic excuse for his behavior, for something that he himself helped to create, this monstrosity. I'm still recovering from those hugs and kisses that day that he claimed that so many rioters, terrorists, were assaulting us that day. If that was hugs and kisses, then we should all go to his house and do the same thing to him.
Now, I have to commend Sergeant Gunnell there by saying, you know, oh, we should go to Trump's house and do it to him on national television inside of a chamber within the House of Representatives. Ballsy move. Understand where you're coming from. I like it. I like the energy. I just thought it was really fascinating that he would say something like that. But, you know, you've got a president saying that, you know, this man endured hugs and kisses on a day where he experienced mass trauma and is suffering PTSD. So I think it's fair to let that one go for Officer Gunnell. The statements like that that Trump make and many other members of the, you know, especially the House Republicans have made, are a disservice to the Capitol Police officers who literally, A, saved their lives, B, have done this every single day for God knows how long, and are also still recovering, maybe with a lack of resources from those events, whether it's lack of access to therapy or funding or it sounds like vacation time or things like that. Might be an issue, they may not be well enough resourced. As a force, they may not be well enough resourced, and that's something else this commission is going to be looking into. But on that rhetoric that we just heard, the one example from Trump, Officer Fanone had a particularly emotional moment on the stand, and I want to play that here just to hear kind of some of his anger come out.
What makes the struggle harder and more painful is to know so many of my fellow citizens, including so many of the people I put my life at risk to defend, are downplaying or outright denying what happened. I feel like I went to hell and back to protect them and the people in this room. But too many are now telling me that hell doesn't exist or that hell actually wasn't that bad. The indifference shown to my colleagues is disgraceful.
That sound you heard there was Fanone slamming his fist on the table as he said it. Officer Fanone was tased by one of the insurrectionists and suffered a heart attack and was hospitalized after, so he had traumatic experiences. But these officers hear what these representatives are saying about, oh, January 6th was just a tourist trip. It wasn't that bad. Oh, they were so nice. They were loving. There were hugs and kisses. These officers hear that. Sergeant Gunnell said that the events of January 6th were worse than anything he experienced on his tour of duty in Iraq. So then for the very people that you're protecting, the elected members of Congress who are there to, A, serve the American people, but should also have the safety of the Capitol Police at the forefront of their minds given this event, these officers hear what these people are saying, undermining what they did that day. One point, I think Gunnell said, if we're going to do this, at least make it worth it to them. And he went on to say he would continue to do it anyway. It's his job. But this is going beyond a thankless job. You're literally telling these people that their experiences didn't happen. It's mockery. And they're suffering these long-term consequences as a result. And they're living with that. And then they have to hear many people, including elected officials, try to whitewash the events of that day. And that is not okay. Not okay at all. Luckily, Representative Adam Kinzinger, one of the Republicans appointed to the commission, does not feel like so many of those other Republicans who are willing to undermine what these officers did that day. So here's Adam Kinzinger addressing the officers during his time to speak.
You guys may like individually feel a little broken. You guys all talk about the effects you have to deal with, and you know, you talk about the impact of that day. But you guys won. You guys held. You know, democracies are not defined by our bad days. We're defined by how we come back from bad days, how we take accountability for that. And for all the overheated rhetoric surrounding this committee, our mission is very simple. It's to find the truth. And it's to ensure accountability.
So you could hear how emotional Kinzinger got when delivering those comments. And it reminds us that empathy is a thing that most human beings should have. He's sitting up there on the dais and he's looking down at them and he is feeling what they went through. He is empathetic to what their experience was. And he's got some military experience, so that might make it a little bit more personal for him. But he's a Republican. He's not politicizing it. He understands what happened on January 6th. He understands what that threat was on January 6th. And he understands what these officers did to protect not only himself, but the other members of Congress and maybe democracy at large. And he's showing that appreciation. What I really enjoyed about watching this committee hearing was there was a sense of bipartisanship. There was a sense of mission. I think we've kind of gotten used to the committee hearings where, you know, we've got the Judiciary Committee or we've got, you know, I can't even remember now during the Trump administration, we had so many, but they're contentious. They're a little bit of theater. They're kind of like a circus. One side is asking legitimate questions. The other side is just making a joke of the whole thing. It's just a lot of political theater. Is it entertaining at times? Sure. Is it productive? Usually not. Although the Kavanaugh hearing maybe should have been, and I'm going to touch on that after this. But this hearing, this January 6th hearing was different. Everybody, all the people that are on the committee had the same demeanor, the same sense of reverence. They'd clearly done their research. If you didn't know their political parties, you would not have known who was a Democrat and who was a Republican. Because they're there on a mission to find the truth about what happened on January 6th, who the players were, how it came to be, how they can stop it from happening again. This is how government is supposed to operate. Disagree on issues, sure. Hopefully compromise on those issues to pass bills that help America. And when something serious happens, like 9/11 or a war or January 6th, you can come together as Americans, under the common cause, under that flag, to do what's right for the country, because it is indisputable what the right thing to do for the country is. It is sad that we are here in this America where half of our elected officials don't think it's important to investigate an attack on our Capitol. Scary. It's actually scary. But I'm glad that Kinzinger spoke the way he did and that Cheney was so thoughtful in her discussions and in her questions. Here's Kinzinger one more time, just on what it means to be on this committee, and also
drawing a distinction between the insurrection and the riots over the summer when George Floyd was killed.
And serving on this committee, I'm here to investigate January 6th, not in spite of my membership in the Republican Party, but because of it. Not to win a political fight, but to learn the facts and defend our democracy. Here's what we know. Congress was not prepared on January 6th. We weren't prepared because we never imagined that this could happen. An attack by our own people, fostered and encouraged by those granted power through the very system they sought to overturn. That is a lesson. That is not a conspiracy theory or a counter-narrative. We don't blame victims. We go after the criminals. Some have concocted a counter-narrative to discredit this process on the grounds that we didn't launch a similar investigation into the urban riots and looting last summer. Mr. Chairman, I was called on to serve during the summer riots as an Air National Guardsman. I condemn those riots and the destruction of property that resulted. But not once did I ever feel that the future of self-governance was threatened like I did on January 6th. There is a difference between breaking the law and rejecting the rule of law, between a crime, even grave crimes, and a coup.
There is a difference between breaking the law and rejection of the rule of law. And that says it all. It could not be said better. It is one thing to break some windows or even set fires and destroy personal property, and those are crimes. But it is another thing entirely to say, we don't want this government. We no longer want this government. We no longer want democracy. We no longer want the other side to be able to cast votes to elect people to office that they want. We want full control. That is a different thing altogether. It is much more serious when push comes to shove, and Kinzinger was very eloquent there in stating it. If you are a moderate Republican, moderate Democrat, and you're looking for someone in the middle, I don't know a ton about Kinzinger. I've seen some of his social media posts. But this is what, you know, if you're going to hold up anyone from the GOP as someone who might be worth looking into in the future for leadership roles or things like that, this is the kind of person that you want. You want someone who feels a responsibility to the country, who does the right thing, who doesn't cave under pressure from idiots in his party like Kevin McCarthy, and while still holding true to his ideals, is able to do what's best for America. So, just like we were talking about with Cuomo, our elected officials should be the best of us. So, for all those people that post really awful stuff on social media or who say outlandish things like Matt Gaetz or Marjorie Taylor Greene, those people, we don't need those people. We need good people. We need good people who are decent human beings, who have a sense of ethics and dignity about them, and who care about integrity and who care about America. Follow them. Stop electing these idiots to office, please. Anyway, I was really happy with the way that Kinzinger and Cheney conducted themselves on the panel, as well as all the Democrats, because it really did look like a united front to figure out what happened on January 6th. And if you were a Republican who didn't want a commission for some reason, or you'd been convinced that this investigation should not be happening, if you watched this hearing, I guarantee you, you would have changed your mind, because you wouldn't have been able to tell who's a Democrat and who's a Republican. You wouldn't have. The questions were objective. They were fair. They were getting good information from these officers, and the officers were fantastic in their descriptions of what happened. They were sincere. They were emotional and clearly angry as well, as they should be. So finally, I want to play Officer Harry Dunn. And just in closing here, this was his opening statement, but I feel like it wraps up the spirit of the investigation. And he was very well spoken throughout. So this is just Harry Dunn, part of his opening statement, just to kind of illustrate what the officers were feeling and kind of what hopefully the spirit of the investigation moving forward will be.
In closing, we can never again allow democracy to be put in peril, as it was on January 6th. I thank the members of the Select Committee for your commitment to determine what led to disaster at the Capitol on January 6th, what actually took place that day, and what steps should be taken to prevent such an attack on our democracy from ever happening again. I also want to thank and acknowledge my brothers and sisters in blue who fought alongside me on January 6th to protect our democracy. Each of you is a hero, and it is my honor to serve with you each and every day. I'd like to thank the American people for all of the support that they have provided these past several months to me and my fellow officers. Lastly, to the rioters, the insurrectionists, and the terrorists of that day, democracy went on that night and still continues to exist today. Democracy is bigger than any one person and any one party. You all tried to disrupt democracy that day, and you all failed.
You tried to disrupt democracy that day, and you all failed. Now, he did say that at the beginning, he said in closing, it was the closing of his opening statement, just to be clear in case you're trying to go find this clip later. But also that he thanked the American people, despite so many Americans not either giving weight to the events of January 6th or outright denying they happened, thanking the American people, thanking the committee, because these officers want the truth. When something terrible happens that involves you, where something terrible happens to you, you want to know why. And we owe it to these officers to figure out why. The last thing I want to play is an interaction that happened after this hearing, I believe the day after. It may have been actually the afternoon. I didn't check, to be honest. But it is an exchange between Representative Jamie Raskin, Democrat, and Republican Jim Clyde. And Jim Clyde is the Republican who made the statement that the attack on January 6th, if you'd watched it on TV, you wouldn't have thought it was anything more than like a routine tourist trip. So after this hearing, Raskin was in a Rules Committee meeting and Clyde was being questioned there, not in relation to this, in relation to something else, actually, but Raskin brought it up. So this exchange is a minute or two, but I think it's really important and I want to talk about the dynamic of it. So hang with me through this clip. It's a good clip. And a lot to talk about on the other side of it.
They were asked the question by several of our colleagues, including Ms. Cheney, about statements that you made saying that the January 6th violent insurrection against Congress was akin to a normal tourist visit. And those officers said they weren't tourists, they were terrorists. Do you stand by your statement that they were tourists?
I would like you to quote my exact statement, not your interpretation of my statement.
Okay. Watching the TV footage of those who entered the Capitol and walked through Statuary Hall showed people in an orderly fashion staying between the stanchions and ropes, taking videos and pictures. You know, if you didn't know the TV footage was a video from January 6th, you would actually think it was a normal tourist visit. Those are your words.
And I stand by that exact statement as I said it.
Okay. Do you agree or disagree with the officers who spent 4 or 5 hours battling that medieval mob that had baseball bats and lead pipes and so on? Do you stand by the statement that the people that they were fighting were tourists, or would you agree with them that they were terrorists?
That statement did not say that those people were tourists. Okay, read the statement.
Okay,
and understand.
Well, I'm asking you now. You've got the opportunity to clarify for the whole country right now for these officers. Officer, I urge you to watch it on TV. I urge you to watch it in your office. Officer Hodges, Officer Fanone, who experienced traumatic brain injury, who had a heart attack after he was tased by some of the tourists or terrorists, Officer Dunn, Officer Hodges, do you think that what they experienced was an attack by tourists or terrorists or violent insurrectionists? You got the opportunity to clarify for the whole country right now.
If you will read the first part
of my
statement.
I'm not interested in that. I'm asking
you're
you.
You're not interested in my statement, are
Mr.
you?
Chair,
the reason I played the entirety of that clip is I think it's really important to understand the dynamic that's at play here. We had Representative Raskin ask Representative Clyde if he stood by his statement about the people being tourists And Jim Clyde said, well, I want you to not misquote my statement. I want you to read my statement. So Raskin read a statement. And in the statement, he said, you know, if you didn't know it was a video from January 6th, you would have thought it was a normal tourist visit. Now, if we're being super lawyer about it, maybe you didn't say that those people were tourists, but you were saying that it looked like a normal tourist trip, which usually by default would imply that what you're seeing on TV were tourists. But no matter, it's simpler than that. This is after the hearing. This is after the clips that I played earlier. And Senator Raskin was asking a very simple question. Would you agree with the officers that the people who stormed the Capitol were terrorists or were they tourists? And all Jim Banks had to say was, those people were terrorists. That is all he had to say. He didn't even have to apologize for his own statement. He could have said, you know what? Those people were terrorists. I'm sorry about this statement. It was not the correct thing to say. And especially upon hearing the officers earlier, who I respect and value their work, those people are absolutely terrorists, and my statement before was incorrect. Not difficult. And remember, he didn't even need to apologize. All he needed to say was, those people were terrorists, not tourists. That's all he had to say. He could have left it there. He could have not answered Raskin's additional questions. He could have left it there. But he couldn't. Why couldn't he say that those insurrectionists were terrorists? Why wasn't he willing to make that clarification in what should have been a very simple answer after, especially, hearing the officers testify hours before? This dynamic is dangerous because what we're seeing is a man who would be willing to call these people tourists if it meant he gets reelected. He's worried about alienating his voters because his voters might believe that those people are not terrorists, even though they clearly are. So it's more important to Jim Clyde, probably, that he remain in office, even if that means calling the people who invaded the Capitol tourists, because his constituents think that way, rather than saying, no, those people were terrorists, and setting an example for his constituents. This is the same dynamic that has overwhelmed like three quarters of the Republican Party. It's this denial of reality. And when we can't understand why they're denying reality, it's because the Trump portion of the party and Trump, they're giving Trump voters so much weight that they're willing to give up their dignity and go against their better judgment in order to appease people who have done nothing to deserve being appeased. People who think that, you know what? The insurrectionists were those were tourists. They were loving people. It was a loving crowd. People believe that. We should not be trying to appease those voters. And honestly, it doesn't matter who they're hearing that from, because anyone with two eyes should be able to make their own judgment. So you can't say, oh, well, you know, their representatives are telling them to think that way, or Fox News is telling them to think that way. No, they're making their own decision. They're adults. They have all the information, and they are choosing to believe that those people were not terrorists. So no, we shouldn't be appeasing those type of voters, especially our elected officials should not be appeasing those type of voters, because those people are making choices that are dangerous. So I just thought it was important to play that clip because it accentuates the type of rhetoric that is happening. That's what the police officers were talking about. Americans who say hell didn't exist or hell wasn't as bad as it was. Well, there you have an elected official who said it out loud, and then even after the hearing, being questioned, could not answer a simple question, were those people terrorists or tourists? And honestly, it's pathetic. It's really pathetic and pitiful, and we should not have pathetic and pitiful people serving us as elected officials in our government. Anyway, I thought the commission was great. I hope they continue to do great work. I hope they continue to do it in a bipartisan way. I think it's really excellent the way that they're doing it, and I hope that nothing bad comes up. Like, I hope that no partisan issue comes up. I hope they maintain this look all the way through because it's important for this report to have legitimacy. So that was the January 6th bit. The last thing I want to talk about is Brett Kavanaugh. Brett Kavanaugh. Oh yeah, he's that guy that there was a hearing on like in 2018 to be a judge and some, you know, it was really weird. It was a really weird hearing. Yes, it was. It was weird for everybody. During Kavanaugh's nomination, prior to his hearing, Some senators on the Judiciary Committee, Senators Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island and Chris Coons of Delaware, had sent a letter to the FBI director, Christopher Wray, basically just saying, hey, there's some stuff here that should be looked into for Kavanaugh. What are you guys doing about it? What is the process? How are these things, you know, these complaints or these tips that are being given, how are they being handled? Who's handling them? Are they being investigated? That letter went unanswered for 3 years until June 30th of this year. On June 30th, Assistant Director of the FBI, Jill Tyson, responded to Senator Whitehouse and Christopher Coons as response to, again, this 2019 letter. In that letter, Assistant Director Tyson said that the most relevant of the 4,500 tips the agency received during an investigation into Mr. Kavanaugh's past were referred to the White House lawyers in the Trump administration, whose handling of them remains unclear. Now, what are these 4,500 tips? For the first time in history, for a judicial nominee, the FBI set up a tip line, and they did this because there were what were seemingly credible accusations against Brett Kavanaugh for sexual assault, namely against a woman, Ms. Christine Blasey Ford, who testified in front of Congress. And this tip line received 4,500 tips. The question is, what happened to those tips? Did the FBI investigate those tips? What Dr. Tyson is saying is, well, no, we didn't investigate the tips. We gave the tips to the White House for them to handle. And we don't really know how they were handled at the White House. When asked for information on this, the then White House counsel, Don McGahn, refused to answer questions. So basically, what this boils down to, in its essence, the letter, is that the FBI asserts that when it does background investigations for the White House, as opposed to criminal investigations, it doesn't actually investigate the information unless the White House requests an investigation, which means when it conducts a background investigation for the White House, the FBI is really nothing more than a message forwarding service. They're just like, hey, we got this thing over here. Hey guys, we got this thing. Just came in. What do you want us to do with it? Oh, just nothing? Okay, cool. Oh, we got this other thing. What do you want us to do with it? Oh, nothing? Okay, cool. And just repeat that 4,500 times. In a recent interview with the author Michael Wolff, President Trump put his handling of Justice Kavanaugh into stark terms, asking, where would he be without me? I saved his life. Let's put the pieces together. FBI has a tip line. Tip line gets 4,500 complaints. FBI doesn't investigate them because the White House didn't tell them to. So they go to the White House and say, hey, we got these 4,500 things over here saying that Kavanaugh might have done like all sorts of shady stuff, whether it's sexual assault or getting money for his debts that mysteriously disappeared. Got a bunch of tips over here, Mr. President. And Mr. President says, no, you don't. And that was the end of that. That's the end of 4,500 tips. And if there were any truth in those 4,500 tips, if there were any evidence of further sexual assault or money laundering or whatever it may have been, that was in there, Donald Trump had full control over Brett Kavanaugh's future. Donald Trump saved Brett Kavanaugh's life. Well, how would Donald Trump have done that? Maybe he did it by ignoring very clear signs, very clear tips that Kavanaugh was in fact guilty or potentially guilty of some of the things that he was being accused of. Interesting when put together. The senators, White House, Coons, and members of the judiciary, they responded to the assistant director's response to them. And they said, your letter confirms that the FBI's tip line was a departure from past practice and that the FBI was politically constrained by the Trump White House. So Dick Durbin signed this letter, Mr. Coons, White House, Cory Booker, like I said, members of the judiciary. Politically constrained by the White House. The Justice Department was politically constrained by the White House. So what could have happened here is that we've appointed a Supreme Court justice to the court for life who had 4,500 tips called in on him. And I'm not saying they're all credible because it's a tip line, so of course they're not. But nothing was followed up on. Nothing. Zero. The FBI did not interview Brett Kavanaugh or Christine Blasey Ford in relation to the allegations that she brought against him. And she testified in front of Congress publicly, yet she was never interviewed by the FBI, and neither was Kavanaugh. It's awful. It was a terrible situation. It's a failure of the entire institution. And I think when it comes to political appointees, do we want the White House to be so in charge that they can just essentially erase any bad stuff that they're bringing forth with their nominees and say, oh, it didn't happen? Because that's what happened here, more than likely. White House released a video on his website referring to the situation. And so just from his perspective, I'd like to play that video here before wrapping up this subject in the episode. So here's Sheldon Whitehouse, who wrote the original letter and has since responded, just talking about this situation from his perspective. And just a quick warning that the audio is a little bit muddy, but I assure you that's part of the actual sound of the video and nothing I could help.
Well, we finally got the answers from the FBI on the fake tip line that they ran for the Kavanaugh investigation. And I'm very happy that so many people have expressed their support for our persistence in digging through until we finally got the answer. But of course, the right-wing attack machine that helped put Kavanaugh on the court is now trying to cloud the issues here. And let me just say, as somebody on the Judiciary Committee, no, there was no summary of what came through the tip line that we were given. The White House didn't give us a summary, the FBI didn't give us a summary, and we had brief access to a room full of papers, no ability to take notes. So the idea that we actually knew this until we had the FBI admit it is just plain false.
So that was Senator Whitehouse talking about this issue, and you heard him bring up the question as to whether or not the Judiciary Committee had some type of summary of the tip line phone calls, and he said, no, they didn't. And of course they didn't, because if the Trump administration is trying to conceal something and they don't need to report on anything and the FBI doesn't need to investigate it and they just pass it up to the White House, why would a summary ever be provided? Once again, wouldn't make sense. So this is bad, though. And I do appreciate Senator Whitehouse and his commitment to this and the rest of the Judiciary Committee, because we can't. Our officials should be our best. They should be our best and they should be our brightest and they should be, you know, deserve to be there. And so if we are appointing people to the Supreme Court who have a history of sexual assault, one, maybe more, because there were multiple people who came forward, but there was a statute of limitations and everything else, as well as some of the other financial questions that were there with Brett Kavanaugh, those things should be, the nomination should be put on pause, put on hold, investigate it, find out what's true, find out what's not. And then the White House should reevaluate whether or not they want to keep that person up. Because even as I said at the time, there are plenty of other options to put up for Supreme Court justice. It doesn't need to be this guy. It doesn't need to be Brett Kavanaugh, or it doesn't need to be any future guy who's got a whole bunch of, like, you know, who's got a black cloud surrounding them and we don't really know what's going on there and would require an investigation. Why not just pick somebody else? Pick somebody else who has a cleaner record and that you're more sure of. The American people deserve better. But for the FBI to essentially be in the pocket of the White House, and this doesn't sound like it was like, the situation itself sounds like this is how it may have played out in any administration, that the investigation needs to be asked by the White House to do an investigation. I think the thing is that past White Houses have felt an obligation to do the investigations when something like this comes up. Trump just didn't. He didn't care. He didn't move forward. Why is this important? Why is this important to bring up years after the fact? It's important because Kavanaugh was confirmed 50 to 48. And any additional information could have been extremely consequential. In total, there were 49 Republicans and one Democrat who voted to confirm Brett Kavanaugh. The one Democrat was, of course, Joe Manchin, because of course, just one more thing to add to his portfolio because, you know, why, Joe? Why? Anyway. And then Lisa Murkowski was technically a no. She didn't vote. And then there was another person there who would have voted yes, and then their votes just kind of canceled out, so she didn't actually vote no. It was just an offset vote. But technically, Lisa Murkowski was a no. So one Republican was a no. And we need a couple more. So, okay, if you flip Manchin and you flip Murkowski, it is now 50-48 the other way, and the Republicans don't have a tie. And even then, very famously, Jeff Flake and Susan Collins were very much on the fence leading up to this vote. Jeff Flake actually looked like a little bit tortured about it. He was confronted by some woman in an elevator who were asking him, you know, like, what are you doing with this? Don't you care about women and women's rights? And so it was a very emotional hearing because they had Me Too going on about the same time. And so it was all just culminating in this hearing. And so two votes, 4,500 tips can probably go a long way in convincing a couple of senators who are already on the fence to maybe not confirm this justice. That's why this stuff is important. That's why it's worth waiting 2 years for an answer and then digging back into it and then bringing it up on this podcast, because that's all it was. It was a razor thin margin, razor thin. And there were other options. Like I said at the time, they could have appointed anyone else. They could have put forth anybody else. They stuck with Brett Kavanaugh. Who knows why they stuck with Brett Kavanaugh, but they did. And maybe he should never have been confirmed in the first place. And so, of course, we don't know what the 4,500 tips were. We don't know if they would have revealed anything else, but it was important. It was important then. We should have, and it's important certainly in the future, to actually follow up on these things, because we should not be appointing people with that type of background. Period. We as Americans, we just deserve better. MSNBC contributor Glenn Kirshner wrote in an article that he believes that first, Congress needs to unearth what went wrong and figure out how to prevent it from happening again with this process. Second, Congress should strive for access to any substantive information from the 4,500 tips collected by the FBI to determine whether any of them screamed out for additional investigation. Well, why rehash it? Because Supreme Court justices can be impeached. And I'm not saying that's like a goal here, but you might be saying, why are we going to follow up on this years after the fact for nothing? It may not be for nothing. There are actually processes which could be followed should Kavanaugh actually have way more sexual misconduct or weird financial stuff going on. That if that should be the case, and most Americans might agree that, like, hey, this guy probably shouldn't be on the court, let's appoint somebody else, there is a way to do that. So it is worth rehashing. So that's the Kavanaugh situation, which I will continue to follow. That's the podcast for today. As always, I am over my hour, just slightly. We covered a lot. We covered COVID. We covered January 6th. We covered Kavanaugh. And we covered Andrew Cuomo and that whole thing. So, COVID. Get vaccinated. COVID, get vaccinated. Big summary. There it is. Get vaccinated so you can get back to normal. Cuomo. Cuomo, you should resign. You should resign and save yourself whatever dignity you have left before you get impeached by literally all of the representatives in the New York Assembly, because they all are going to impeach you. Okay? January 6th. Hope that hearing goes well. Hope it stays impartial. Hope they get some great information. Glad to see bipartisanship in government for the first time in a while. So, January 6th Commission, good on you. Look forward to hearing more from you. And Brett Kavanaugh, well, we got to fix the process. We got to fix the investigation. That's the biggest thing. Fix the process. Find a way to make that better for future nominees. The American people get better representatives in the courts, and also maybe, you know, follow up on, you know, if anything actually needed to be investigated of those 4,500 tips. And once again, just one more piece in there that the Trump White House was maybe far more manipulative than we thought, and more information keeps coming out, and more information keeps coming out, and we're headed somewhere. We don't know where. But, you know, there's a conclusion to that story, and hopefully we'll get it soon. So thank you very much for listening to the New Deal podcast. Head on over to the Facebook page, join the New Deal community group, join the debate, join the discussion. I would appreciate any feedback there. Check out some of my other episodes. Rate, review will always be appreciated. Head on over to YouTube and just continue checking out the New Deal. Let me know how I'm doing. I really appreciate you guys listening. New Deal out.